There's a famous saying, strict parents make the best liars. Now, at first glance, many might assume that this is referring to when teenagers might lie about having a boyfriend or girlfriend, or pretend to be sleeping as they plan to sneak out to go to a party. But according to experts, strict parenting can turn children into adept liars, as they do not feel safe telling the truth. Now, that might make you wonder, what exactly would make a child feel like they have to lie in order to protect their safety? In Jennifer Pond's case, not only does she spend almost half of her life pretending to be someone she isn't in front of her parents, but even goes as far as to attempt to get rid of them when they eventually find out. Welcome to the sixth episode of For When Forensics Fail, the podcast where we explore various applications of behavioral analysis to different aspects of crime. In this episode, we will be reviewing the case of Jennifer Pond. Jennifer was born in Markham, Ontario, and raised with her older brother by immigrant Vietnamese parents. She used to devote all of her time and energy into figure skating, but she injured her knee and was informed that she couldn't compete early on. Because of this, her parents' high standards had to be met the more traditional method, by focusing on academics. Her parents were expecting consecutive A's from her, but she was averaging a C-. She began to falsify her report cards, which led her to faking her high school graduation, and even an acceptance letter from the University of Toronto, desperate to match their expectations. Jennifer appeared to her parents to be on her way to a prosperous profession in healthcare, while in reality, she was a high school dropout living with her boyfriend, whom she had been covertly dating for nearly 8 years. Her parents found out about her double life in 2018 and offered her an ultimatum: return home, cut off all social links, and only leave the house to seek studies, or be disowned, never return home, and receive no financial support. What choice did Jennifer take? Neither. She created a third option. She had her boyfriend stage a mock home invasion, in which three of his friends would break into the Pond home, ransack it, and then murder the parents. Jennifer unlocked the door about 11 p.m. on the day of, and three males were spotted walking into the Pond's home and then exiting 18 minutes later, according to a neighbor's security camera. Around this time, Jennifer dialed 911, pleading for help, stating that someone had broken into her house, robbed them, and tied her up. Her mother was shot twice and died instantly, while her father was hit twice as well, but somehow survived. After the event, he was put into an induced coma, and Jennifer waited by his bedside for 3 hours before being escorted to the police station for questioning. She was treated as a victim and witness during about the first 16 minutes of her stay at the police station. When she told the scenario to the investigator, her emotional responses seemed normal. However, she appears to have been driven over the edge when talking about her mother. Then all of a sudden, she pulls herself together and explains what happened next in a very structured and coherent manner. Consider a time when you were irritated about something. What did you say when someone inquired what was wrong? Because you're still attempting to process your thoughts, you're not likely to convey what happened gently or calmly. Instead, you're more likely to blurt forth words in a forceful and unstructured manner. The difficulty of converting cognition into dialogue is exacerbated by emotional hysteria. Jennifer appears to be more concerned with how she is regarded, but she finds words readily and delivers her message flawlessly. Despite the fact that she has clearly figured out her story, she does notice how strange it was that she was able to make a phone call with her hands tied at one point. When she notices this, she pauses, stutters, and glances up at the detective for confirmation before continuing with her explanation. Jennifer, at times during the interview, takes a few seconds to realize that she's not behaving properly when she grins, and then she snaps back into her firm stare. Because these two appearances are so dissimilar, it's clear that she's faking one of the emotions. She called back 2 days later to provide another statement as both a victim and a witness, while also being an unofficial primary suspect. They begin the process of cross-examination in this interview, attempting to catch her in her lies as the flaws in her story become increasingly evident. When she tries to retell the story, she can elicit emotion while speaking, but it vanishes as soon as the interrogator asks her another question. This is due to the fact that acting out an emotion and answering a question necessitates the employment of two separate parts of the brain, which is incredibly challenging to do at the same time. Her pattern repeats itself throughout the interrogation, further exposing her. Jennifer continues to contradict herself, and she is compelled to correct herself several times after noticing the detective's bewildered expression. Jennifer's father had awoken from his coma the day before his wife's burial, at which Jennifer had been described as emotionless. Jennifer's father unexpectedly remembered everything that happened that day and notified the police. Several elements of his story contradicted Jennifer's account to the police. The most major inconsistency was that Jennifer was not restrained and that she was wandering freely, conversing with the invaders as if they were friends. She was asked to return for another interrogation a week and a half after the incident, now that the police had Jennifer's father's statement. The third investigator takes his time gaining Jennifer's trust and creating rapport, but once this is accomplished, the switch to hostility will be swift and exponentially growing from there. She revised her story after about 4 hours, saying that she hired individuals to kill her instead, and that it didn't go as planned. Jennifer pleaded not guilty to all accounts March 14, 2014. 116 text messages between Jennifer and her boyfriend describing the crime in detail were recovered by forensics, which was enough to convict them both, as well as all of the invaders who were linked to the crime via DNA evidence and witness testimony. Jennifer's parents had an authoritarian parenting style, which is marked by excessive demands and a lack of responsiveness. Parents that have an authoritarian parenting style have high expectations of their children but provide little feedback or caring, and when feedback is given, it is frequently negative. In the authoritarian method, yelling and corporal punishment are often popular. Authoritarian parents do not encourage their children to explore and behave autonomously, so they never learn to define their own boundaries and personal standards. Now, I'm not implying that anybody who raises their children in this manner will end up in Jennifer's parents' shoes, but it might lead to sentiments of bitterness and wrath as they grow older. While rules and boundaries are crucial for a child's development, a lack of warmth, love, and nurturing can have a significant impact on not only how your child views the world and you, but also how they view themselves. Thank you for listening to the 4-1 Forensics Fail podcast. For episode transcripts and resources, visit our Notion page, which can be found in the podcast description box of whatever platform you are listening on. Signing off!